Listen to this. Marcy comes over and she tells me that her ex-boyfriend was over late last night and yada, 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 I'm really tired today.
What do you think she was tired from?
Well, obviously the yada, yada. You don't think she'd yada, yada sex?
I've yada, yada sex.
Really?
Yeah. I met this lawyer. We went out to dinner. I had the lobster bisque. We went back to my place. Yada, yada, yada. I never heard from him again.
But you yada, yada over the best part.
No, I mentioned the bisque.
One of my favorite lines in Seinfeld history, and written by our next guest. His name is Peter Melman, who started out as a writer on that show and worked his way up to producer and eventually co-executive producer of Seinfeld, which is going to hit Hulu next week. All the episodes of Seinfeld, which up until now have been so hard to find, will be available on Hulu. Peter also has a novel that's just out called It Won't Always Be This Great and joins us now. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, how you doing, Paul?
Will yada yada be in your obituary?
It looks that way. I mean, I would have to do something pretty drastic, you know, like, I don't know. I'd have to cause some kind of major catastrophe or something like that.
You not only came up with yada yada, you also came up with the double dip.
Yes.
And shrinkage. All things that became part of everybody's everyday conversation, and I can't help but wonder if at any point in meetings at Seinfeld, somebody said, "Okay, who's got a catchphrase that we can get America to go viral with this week?"
No, that was all. Every one of them was purely accidental, and every one of them, every time the reaction was so huge, we were kind of surprised. The funny thing is, the only time I wrote something like a catchphrase or a word that I thought my cat take off was anti-dentite. And that did not take off because it was in the same episode as yada yada. So,
which had Bryan Cranston as dentist Tim Watley.
Wow, you're up on your stuff.
Yeah. Well, I've seen all the shows, and I've also seen Bryan Cranston interviewed a lot in the last few years as Breaking Bad came to an end. So, yeah, that was uppermost in my mind. How did you get the Seinfeld job?
Craigslist. No. I had met Larry David when I was living in New York in the late 80s. I'd met him twice. I moved out here to L.A. just, you know, in kind of changed my life up a little bit in 89. And then I bumped into Larry about a year later. And he said, you know, I'm going to be doing this little TV show with Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe you could write a script. And, you know, he knew I was a writer, but he had no idea that I'd never really written dialogue or scripts.
Mm-hmm.
I had been a journalist, mainly. And but I got to write a script, and it all worked out.
What was that first script? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. It was called The Apartment. It was when Jerry kind of, like, unthinkingly tells Elaine that a woman in his building died and there's an open apartment.
Yeah. And she wants to move in.
Yeah, and then Jerry realizes that, you know, with his ex-girlfriend in the building, he would have to have all his sex, like, on the road. He would lose the home bed advantage.
Home bed advantage. Another great phrase. So I'm always curious about process, Peter, and I'm wondering when somebody would come up with an idea, whether it's you or another writer or maybe a cast member, I don't even know if they contributed ideas, would you have to vet it with Jerry and Larry first before you got the green light to go ahead and write the script?
Yes. In a word, yes. The funny thing is, in the very, very first script I wrote, that episode, The Apartment, all I had was that storyline with Jerry and Elaine, and as I was writing, I kind of threw in this other storyline where George is wearing a wedding ring to see whether girls would actually, you know, come on to him more. And it's funny that it wound up in there because that never really happened again where, you know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, Larry's reading a script, and there's a whole storyline in there that he'd never heard of.
Mm-hmm. And so would you go in there and pitch it to both of these guys? Because I know they had an office with desks facing each other, and was it just a stand up and tell us a one-line pitch?
Yes. That's what it should have been, you know, because I always thought to myself, somehow I understood very early that if you could pitch it in one line, that would be the best. Yeah. One, possibly two lines, and get the laugh, that's how it would work out best.
And
you know, sometimes I would just pass it by Larry. But most of the time, both of them.
And how was it different after Larry left? You became a co-executive producer in the last couple of seasons after he was gone. So were you the person that other people pitched things to, or was it just Jerry alone at that desk?
Well, it was much more of a group effort. You know, it was much more like we're all agreeing to it. I was actually only there for 1 year after Larry had left, so I don't know what it was like in the final season. But I had left before the final season.
All right, now, Seinfeld leads us into talking about your book, which is called It Won't Always Be This Great, which is a novel about a guy who is, he's having a midlife crisis, right?
Yeah, a mini crisis, I would say. You know, he's a guy who is a podiatrist, and he's got a wife and kids who he loves incredibly deeply. I was thinking, like, this was like a whole new genre. It's a marriage that actually works. You know, who writes about that?
Yeah.
So he gets angry one night at something and commits this small act of vandalism, and instead of following his normal pattern where he would just own up to it and go to the police and fess up and pay, he just walks away. And it kind of grows into being seen as a hate crime.
It becomes a hate crime?
Yes, because he threw a bottle. He ended up throwing a bottle through. He tripped over this bottle on the street and got so angry that he threw the bottle, and it went through the plate glass window of a store owned by a very prominent Orthodox Jew in this little Long Island town.
Uh-huh.
And he just walked away. And, you know, suddenly his life is, you know, threatened with being completely unraveled.
And later on, everybody's charging him with being an anti-dentite. I see how you bring it all around.
Yeah.
Very nice. Now, when you're writing a novel, which I've never done, but I know one of the things that you have to do is interweave a lot of stories. It can't just be about the podiatrist. You've got to have all these other characters and their backstories and side stories. And I wonder if doing that for the four characters on Seinfeld, because there were so many of those episodes where each of the four of them, Jerry, George, Elaine, and Kramer, had separate stories that had to either cross over each other or resolve close to each other towards the end. Did that inform the way you then became a novelist and how you wrote the novel?
You know, it certainly helped, but I don't think it helped me that much more than any of my other previous writing experiences. You know, like writing for the Washington Post and writing for Esquire and the New York Times Magazine and all the other places that I published, you know, also had an impact, a huge impact, because, you know, I got to be very good at observing the world. And, you know, I worked for Howard Cosell for a few years, and that kind of informed certain amounts of it. And, you know, and to tell you the truth, I used to kid Jerry that, you know, that he was the second funniest boss I ever had. Because Howard Cosell was such a riot.
All right, well, now that you've touched on it, we have to stop here for just a moment and examine this concept for a moment. Howard Cosell was funny?
Howard Cosell was incredibly funny.
How was he as a boss?
He was great. I was worked up with him on a show called Sports Beat. It was a sports journalism program, much like, you know, Brian Gumbel's show now.
Yeah.
And we had a very small staff, and he was a very protective boss, and you know, he was great. It was like being in the center of the sports universe. It was really amazing.
How long was it that you worked on that show before you could do a Howard Cosell imitation?
Oh, I could do it when I was 13. But you know something? The funny thing is, when we would have meetings, everybody would be talking in his voice.
In front of him?
There'd be like four or five guys in there, and we'd all be doing his impressions with him there.
And he didn't mind, obviously.
No, he thought it was hysterical.
Wow. Now, I got to go back to the book for a second, because I'm not sure I've ever read a book where the protagonist was a podiatrist. A, why? B, did you have to do research?
What Well, I had a college roommate who was a podiatrist, so I definitely got some great technical assistance from Dr. Stephen Kaminsky in Washington, D.C. And I am going to be, I'm thoroughly embarrassed to admit to you why I made him a podiatrist, but I'm going to tell you.
Good.
I needed a profession, and I had one joke lying around about a podiatrist, and the funny thing is it's much more of a physical, of a visual joke. I always thought it would be funny if a podiatrist had one of those pine scents around his neck. And I just had that joke lying around, so I said, you know what, I'll incorporate that joke into the book, and I'll make him a podiatrist.
There you go. I have a joke, I'll eventually work that into something, and you did. Good for you.
I'm telling you, it's, you know, any way you can get it done. You know, everybody tells you about all the ways of, like, what you have to do to write a novel, and I'm like, you know, I don't agree with any of that.
I want to ask you about a couple of other TV projects of yours. You worked on Joe Buck's short-lived HBO series, didn't you?
I worked on it for one episode. And
was it the Artie Lang episode?
Yes.
How'd that go?
Well, everything went poorly. I was in Los Angeles, and I was going to come in for the taping of the show. And I was on conference calls pretty much every day, and you know, I would suggest ideas and things, and, you know, Joe would laugh hysterically at it, and the next day he would always kind of back off and say, I don't know, it's a little dicey to go into that area, something like that. So humor-wise, I guess, in a weird way, we weren't connecting. I mean, we both... We connected on what we thought was funny, but we didn't connect on what should be on the air.
Mm.
And then when I heard that Artie Lang was going to be on, this was on a big conference call with everybody involved. I said, really? Are you sure about that? They said, yeah, why not? I said, I don't know. He's kind of a loose cannon, isn't he?
Yeah, we know it's HBO, but this might be a little extra for us.
Yeah, and so, you know, I have to say, you know, I totally love Joe Buck as an announcer on football, and now on golf he's even incredible.
I saw that. He was doing golf last night.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just felt like, you know, everything I said was somehow getting vetoed. So, like, what was the point of having me flown into New York first class and stay at a hotel and everything like that when nobody... When, you know, it was 3 days before the show and none of my contributions or attempts at contributions were really being accepted. So I kind of bowed out.
And after you bowed out and saw what the product actually turned out to be, did you think to yourself, well, maybe this is not the right vehicle for Joe?
Well, I think what Joe found out is that there's kind of a big difference between saying funny one-liners on a sports event than it is being an actual comedy. Because, you know, when nobody's really expecting you to be funny, it's a little bit easier to be funny.
Yes.
But doing a show where, you know, you have the express purpose of being funny, that makes it really difficult. And, you know, he's far from the first person to come into contact with that bit of difference between those two areas. So, you know, I was sorry that it didn't work out, but on the other hand, I probably haven't given it a thought for about 3 years. So.
Well, you know, the thing that you just said about, you know, you are talented in this area and you can be quick and funny in that area, but then expanding that to hosting your own show and trying to do something else, it reminds me a lot of when executives would think, well, this person's a funny guest on talk shows. Why don't we give him or her a talk show? And then you end up with the Magic Johnson Hour.
Yeah, and I don't even remember him being funny or amusing before that.
Well, he was okay if he was there with Arsenio Hall, but when
he's an incredibly personable guy, but hosting a show is a whole different thing.
Don't I know it.
Yeah. Nobody knows it better than you.
Now, I do have to ask you about one other TV show, and that was something that you did that I liked, and I was disappointed when it went off the air, and it was a series that was on ABC in 1999 called It's Like You Know. Which
I love that show. That was a blast.
Among its cast had the wonderful actor Evan Handler, who I thought was great, and the beautiful A.J. Langer. And you also had Jennifer Grey playing Jennifer Grey. And it was about a bunch of people in Los Angeles who were friends who hung out. And she played herself. And there was no compunction about making fun of her surgically changed nose. And I wonder if at any point you had to actually take her aside and say, how do you feel about this? And did she go for it?
I pulled her aside to tell her that before the show even started, you know, before she was even hired. I said, this is what I'd like to do. And she was totally game. You know, she's a dear friend, even before the show. So, you know, she trusted me, and I told her, if there's anything you ever feel uncomfortable with, tell me, and I'll take it out. And so, and she never did.
Wow. Wow. Now, what I've heard is that you actually produced two seasons of that show, but that ABC only aired one. Is that right?
Well, they aired about five or six episodes of the second season. There are about maybe seven episodes that never aired.
Where are they?
You got me. No, they are on YouTube.
Oh.
And, they can be found on YouTube, but they, for some reason, it never came out on video. I don't know.
Does being part of a huge success like Seinfeld and then being part of a, let's call it, disappointment, like It's Like You Know, affect your status in Hollywood?
That's a good question. I suppose so. I mean, I suppose it did at the time. I guess. I mean, you know, then again, I mean, it doesn't completely wipe it out, but, yeah, I guess it probably said, oh, man, you know, maybe this guy can't do it other than Seinfeld. But, you know, the funny thing was, after Seinfeld, when I was pitching It's Like You Know to the networks, what I realized is that all the networks hated Seinfeld. They liked the show as fans, but they hated the fact that it broke all the rules, that the characters weren't likable, that the characters were friends, yet would, you know, they'd kind of screw each other over at the drop of a hat.
Yep.
The characters were glib. You know, the networks hated that, and they didn't really, you know, adapt to it at all. You know, in fact, one of the characters, you know, they complained that his acting seemed glib. So I said to the head of the network, I said, well, he seems glib because I told him to be glib. And, you know, they looked at me like, no, he's got to be likable. And I'm like, what is this, 1958? You know, it was, you know, there was a lot of frustration about it. But, you know, I did the show I wanted to do. And, you know, you do the best you can with it. You live with the results, as LeBron James said.
Yeah. And now you got this novel. It's called It Won't Always Be This Great. Good luck with that. And thanks so much for joining us here today, Peter. A pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Paul. Take care.